Jewish ministers of the 19th century Free Church. Falling off a camel in the Egyptian desert would seem an unlikely providence to result in six European Jews becoming ministers of the Free Church of Scotland. Yet Andrew Bonar commented, "But for that fall, our fathers in the deputation would not have sailed up the Danube on their way to Vienna, and pest would not have been visited. This accident was the occasion of directing the steps of our two fathers to that station, where a severe stroke of sickness was made the means of detaining Dr. Keith till they had learned that there was an open door among the Jews. There is nothing but truth in the remark made by one of our number. Dr. Black's fall from the camel was the first step towards pest." This paper looked at the interesting histories of the six Jews who became ministers, all but one of them as a direct or indirect result of the mission to Pest, which is nowadays part of Budapest in Hungary. I'll describe their personal histories and their extensive missionary labours for the Free Church, which spread over a vast area of mainland Europe, from Amsterdam in the west to Istanbul in the east, and from Hamburg in the north to the south of Italy. Their labours also involved evangelising British Jews and teaching Hebrew in Free Church divinity halls. Information about most of these men is quite hard to come by. You'll not find any written account of them as a group, so this paper is breaking new ground in Scottish church history. And it draws on information from a range of British and foreign language sources. By way of introduction to this topic, I'll briefly cover some historical points. In the pre-Reformation European Church, Jewish blasphemies against Christ caused outrage, and anti-Semitic behaviour was rife. This was compounded by the slur that Jewish forefathers had murdered Christ. And pogroms were common over the centuries, particularly when the myth arose that the Jews needed the blood of Christian infants for their feasts. Now, the Reformation gradually led to a change within most of the Protestant churches. We can think particularly of the Directory of Public Worship, which required ministers to pray every Lord's Day for the conversion of the Jews, and also the answer to the larger Catechism, question 191, what do we pray for in the second petition? That included the obligation to pray for the calling of the Jews. Protestant missions to the Jews did not begin until the Moravian Church acted in the 18th century, if we ignore for the moment the bizarre belief that Native Americans were descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. And that delusion had spurred the SSPCK, the Society in Scotland for Propagating Christian Knowledge, to support missionary work in North America, including funding the work of David Brainerd. Now, let's look specifically at Scotland, however. Jews had lived and worked unmolested in Scotland since the 13th century. In the 17th century, Jewish lecturers taught Hebrew at Edinburgh and Aberdeen universities. In the 18th century, Jewish students enrolled at three Scottish universities. And by 1780, there was an established Jewish community in Scotland, although it was not religiously organised. However, there was no attempt to evangelise among them. It was not until the 19th century that Scottish prayers and sermons about conversion of the Jews turned into concrete actions, first by supporting interdenominational societies working in England, and later through the actions of the Church of Scotland among European Jews. Two of the voluntary societies will feature in this paper, so I'll just spend a moment on them. The first was the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. It was founded in 1809 by evangelical Anglicans, including William Wilberforce and Charles Simeon. However, they contended that the baptism of Jews was invalid if it was administered by ministers who were not episcopally ordained. Now, unsurprisingly, Scottish Presbyterians took offence at that. The General Assembly of the Church of Scotland enthusiastically supported the formation of the other main interdenominational organisation, which was the British Society for the Propagation of the Gospel Among the Jews, founded in 1842. And Robert Murray McShane opened the inaugural meeting with prayer in the Scottish Church at Regent Square in London. Let's now look briefly at the Church's own denominational work, namely the mission at Pest in Hungary. The story of the mission of inquiry to Palestine in 1839 ought to be well known to us from Andrew Bonar's memoir of McShane, and I quoted from Bonar's account. Bonar and McShane's full narrative report has been republished in recent years as Mission of Discovery. So who were the two men who reached Pest? The man who fell from the camel was Dr. Alexander Black. He'd been a minister in Aberdeenshire before being appointed Professor of Divinity at Marshall College, Aberdeen. He was a skilled linguist, speaking 19 languages and able to write in 12. And he was profoundly acquainted with Jewish and rabbinical literature. The other was Dr. Alexander Keith, minister of the coastal village of St. Cyrus in Concardineshire. He was internationally famous for writing a book on the fulfillment of prophecy as an evidence of the truth of the Bible. Archduchess Maria Dorothea of Hungary had been reading his book and took a great interest in him when he fell severely ill in Pest. Maria Dorothea was a Protestant who had married the Roman Catholic Archduke Joseph of Hungary. And Bonar commented that although Keith could scarcely speak any language, he had such a kind and winning way that he never failed to get what he wanted. Now, once it was decided to establish a mission in Pest, four ministers were sent from Scotland: John Duncan, Robert Smith, William Wingate, and William Owen Allen, who was a son-in-law of Dr. Duncan. And of course, I must mention the best known of them, John Duncan. He served only temporarily as a missionary, returning to Scotland to become the very personification of an absent-minded professor. Yet under God's blessing, the lasting benefits of Duncan's brief missionary career in Hungary left an incalculable legacy, not only to the Jewish community, but also to the wider Hungarian church. Not only was he thoroughly proficient in Hebrew and all the related languages, he knew at least four Indian languages, Bengali, Hindi, Marathi, and ancient Sanskrit. He enjoyed a high degree of fluency in many European languages, and had an amazing ability to express himself in the most elegant Latin. Within 3 months of his arrival in Hungary, he mastered both the vocabulary and the difficult grammar of the Hungarian language. And Thomas Guthrie said about Dr. Duncan and Dr. Black, together they were so proficient in languages, ancient and modern, that they could talk their way to the Great Wall of China. Well, it was strategic for the missionaries to cultivate friendly relations with as many people of influence as possible, including Hungarian Reformed, Lutheran, and Roman Catholic clergy, as well as leaders in the Jewish community. Duncan's personal circle of acquaintances included the chief rabbi, with whom he had much in common, and shared a scholarly knowledge of the Hebrew language and Judaism, as well as delighting in mathematics and philosophy. And Duncan took a great interest in the Jewish schools and offered two Hebrew Bibles and two copies of the Torah as prizes, as well as donating an English Bible complete with New Testament to the headmaster. Duncan's friendship with the chief rabbi blossomed, and no doubt this facilitated the mission's work. And Duncan's relations with one of the few evangelical pastors of the Episcopalian Hungarian Reformed Church, Pál Turek, was essential to the work of the mission, as foreigners were not allowed to conduct marriages or baptisms. Let's now turn then to the six Jewish ministers. The first man I would like to tell you about is Sander Tomery, who was one of the first converts of the Pest mission. As you'll appreciate, the map of Europe has changed beyond all recognition since the 19th century. The Habsburg and Ottoman empires and the Kingdom of Prussia have disappeared. And international borders and place names have changed often a number of times. So, by and large, I will refer to the present-day names of countries and places in this paper. Sander Tomery was born in 1818 in a small town in the east of Moravia, which is now the Czech Republic. The Jewish population there was confined to 17 houses in one street, effectively a small ghetto for over 500 Jews. At the age of 14, Sander Tomery left home due to religious conflict within his family. He went to the Moravian city of Brunn, which is nowadays Brno, where he completed his secondary education in a gymnasium, that is the name given in various countries to a school which prepares pupils for university. He then attended university in central Hungary before moving to the Hungarian capital to study medicine. And it was as a young medical student that Sander Tomery began to show an interest in Christianity. He approached a Roman Catholic bishop from Vienna who felt unable personally to offer any meaningful help. And amazingly, the prelate encouraged him to consult the Protestant missionaries in Pest instead. And Tomery vividly recalled the first occasion he and John Duncan met. And it gives a wonderful, if slightly amusing, insight into Duncan's eccentricities. They conversed in Latin, as John Duncan hadn't learned Hungarian by then. And here's Tomery's account of it. "I was introduced to the dear man. In a most syllogistic way, that is by deductive reasoning, and in fluent Latin, he brought out the truth of the gospel and urged me to accept Christ as my saviour. But quite in keeping with the character of the doctor, with the ruling passion, in the same breath he began to teach me in English. While the tears were yet in my eyes and his, he began to conjugate an English verb and made me repeat it. After that, I saw him almost daily." Sander Tomery abandoned his medical course in 1843 and went to Edinburgh to study theology in the newly formed Free Church. For the benefit of English speakers, he anglicised his first name, Sandor, as Alexander, and also modified the spelling of his surname. He was licensed when he completed his studies in 1847, and he proceeded to Constantinople, which is now Istanbul in Turkey, where there was a community of 80,000 Jews from various sects. At first he worked as a teacher among them, and then 11 years later, in 1858, at a meeting of the Presbytery of Edinburgh, Professor George Smeaton formally ordained him to Jewish missionary work. In Constantinople, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, Alexander Tomori preached each Lord's Day in Spanish, and later in the day in English to Scottish engineers who were employed at the arsenal in the city. He was noted for his linguistic gifts. He used these in the service of the gospel, as he could speak and preach in seven languages, mainly German, English, and Spanish, but he not infrequently preached in Italian and French as well. Tomori was highly respected by both the British and German communities in Constantinople, and he often performed marriages, baptisms, and funerals for the Germans, and conducted the services at the German embassy chapel when the chaplain was absent on furlough. He was also appointed as the chaplain to the Dutch embassy in Constantinople. He remained in Constantinople for 48 years until his death in 1895 at the age of 77. Before considering the fruits of his missionary labours, I will briefly allude to family links to the northeast and north of Scotland. Tomery married a lady from Aberdeen who worked in the Constantinople Free Church Mission. One of their sons was also named Alexander, and he, born at Constantinople, studied in Aberdeen at the University and the Free Church College, and then in Leipzig. And he was ordained in 1887 as a missionary to the Free Church in Calcutta. Another son served for a few years as a doctor in Halkirk, Caithness, but left with Sutherland Rifle Volunteers to take part in the Boer War. A daughter of that doctor, Louise Thomery, graduated in medicine from Aberdeen University and had a notable career in South Africa, and a prize in her name, the Louise Thomery Prize, is still awarded annually to the most distinguished female medical graduate at Aberdeen University. Well, leaving aside and behind my digression about Thomery's family, let's consider his work among the Jews during these 48 years as a servant of Christ. He was noted as having an apt way of reasoning with Jewish inquirers. His obituary notes that his use of the Old Testament as a preparation for Christ, his eloquent preaching, his fervent prayers, and his self-consuming zeal would long be remembered by those who came in contact with him or watched his work. His labours among his Jewish brethren bore fruit, as it was said that few Jewish missionaries had the satisfaction of admitting into the fellowship of the Church of Christ so many converts. So there, in a nutshell, is the remarkable life and usefulness of one of the first converts of the Pest Mission. The second Jewish minister I will consider is a man who had begun the Free Church mission in Constantinople back in 1843. This man was therefore a predecessor of Thomery there, but for a brief period only before going on to work in Berlin, Amsterdam and London. The Pest mission features briefly but significantly in his history, and it's just a reminder to us that not all the Jewish ministers of the Free Church were converts of the Pest mission. Solomon Schwartz was born in Prussia in 1817, in a town that is now in eastern Poland near the border with Belarus. He intended to become a rabbi and went to study the Hebrew language and literature in Berlin. However, when he was in Berlin, he came under the power of the gospel, and in 1837, at the age of 20, he publicly professed the name of Christ. He was baptized in the Prussian Lutheran Church and took the names Karl Augustus Ferdinand instead of Solomon. After studying theology in Halle and Berlin, Karl Schwartz felt called to become a missionary to the Jews and was accepted for service by the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. Now, in keeping with the strong Anglican orientation of that society, he had to be made an Anglican deacon, and then he set off for Constantinople to work there. And on the way there, he visited Pest and met with the Scottish missionaries. They persuaded him to stay in the city for a while to preach to the Jews in German. And Karl Schwartz's preaching was blessed to the Safir family. I'll say more about them at the end of the paper. For the moment, I'll just note that a year later, Schwartz married a sister of the well-known Adolf Safir. Schwartz wanted to remain in Pest, but the London Society insisted on him proceeding to Constantinople, where 60 Jews attended his services at first. At the time of the disruption, he chose to join the Free Church and took the mission with him, which is how that mission in Istanbul transferred to the Free Church of Scotland. Schwartz went to Scotland in 1844, and there he was ordained by the Presbytery of Edinburgh as a missionary to the Jews. He was not to return to Constantinople, however. Instead, he was appointed to work in Berlin, a city where over 2,000 Jews had already been baptized as Christians. His 4 years in Berlin, however, were described as a test of his patience, a time of much thought and serious preparation. Schwartz remained in Berlin until the Free Church mission closed in 1848, and after that he would like to have worked in Prague, which boasted the largest Jewish community in the world. At that time, Prague was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but the Austrian authorities refused him permission to work in Prague. So the Free Church sent him instead to Amsterdam to assess whether it would be possible to work among that city's large Jewish community. And this resulted in Schwartz being settled there, helped for a few years by the Reverend Robert Smith, who had also been one of the Scottish missionaries in Pest. Now, Amsterdam had a Jewish community since the 16th century. To begin with, largely Sephardic Jews ejected from Portugal and Spain. Over the centuries, they were assimilated into Dutch society, working as successful merchants and forming a small but significant middle-class group with their own synagogues. And over the centuries, a few thousand Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazi Jews sought refuge in Amsterdam from troubles in Central and Eastern Europe. And then a massive influx of impoverished Ashkenazi Jews took place during the 19th century, largely because of pogroms, bringing the population of the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam to around 50,000. And many of them eventually worked in the city's Jewish-controlled diamond industry. Well, Schwartz worked among the Amsterdam Jews for 15 years, from 1849 to 1864. The first years of his sojourn were darkened by the death of his wife, Maria Dorothea Safier. A few years later, he married a sister of Amsterdam's Dutch mayor. And from the beginning, the Scottish missioner there was strongly supported by two influential converted Dutch Jews, Abraham Cappadoza, a minister of the Dutch Church, and Isaac da Costa, a renowned poet. And behind them was the very active Dutch committee of the Vrienden Israels, the Friends of Israel. What was his success among the Dutch Jews? Well, at first, Schwartz preached in German with a Dutch translator to 20 or 30 Jews. He soon learned to speak and preach in Dutch, and his congregation grew to nearly 200. He was very active among the Jewish community by preaching, by issuing tracts, and editing a religious magazine for them. And gradually the congregation outgrew the capacity of a former Persian church that he used. The Free Church then bought a former theatre with two rows of galleries to repurpose it as a church, and this seated a total of 1,400. The building also housed a Reformed seminary, which Schwartz helped to establish, though this served Dutch theological students rather than Jews. Now, Schwartz was awarded a Doctor of Divinity by the German University of Gießen in 1864, and that year he accepted a call to become a minister of Trinity Chapel in London as successor to another converted Jew, Ridley Herschel. Simultaneously, he was appointed as the agent of the Free Church mission in London. In 1867, Dr. Schwartz became a collegiate minister of Harrow Road Presbyterian Church, where he remained until his death, aged 53. While ministering to these London congregations, he published a regular evangelistic magazine for Jews. He also continued mission work among the Jewish population of London and managed to unite disparate groups of converted Jews into one single body. We've seen something of the extent of Schwartz's labour among the Jews. And moving on now to the third of the Free Church's Jewish ministers, we'll look at a converted Jew who was also influenced by Schwartz and who went on to play a large role in the Free Church and elsewhere. Jonas, or Jonas Meyer, was born in 1819 in a town in northern Prussia, 75 miles east of Hamburg. His parents were not strict Jews, and they sent Jonas to the state school at the age of six. In God's providence, he received a general instruction from Herr Kohl, a Christian teacher. However, Meyer went on to complete a course of Jewish study as well, and in 1842 he became a rabbi in a congregation where he remained for 3.5 years. Jonas Meyer was greatly influenced by the chief rabbi of that Prussian province of Mecklenburg. And by then, Judaism had divided into two parties, Reformed Jews and Orthodox Jews. And Meyer followed the chief rabbi into the party of Reformed Jews. This is probably the appropriate time to explain these two sects of Judaism, not only in relation to Meyer, but also to the work of the Free Church among European Jews. Just as there was a European Enlightenment, there was also a Jewish Enlightenment movement known as the Haskalah among the Jews of Central and Eastern Europe. And the Haskalah began at the end of the 18th century in Berlin and spread to various other Jewish centres, and then petered out at the end of the 19th century. What did it believe? Well, it opposed the dominance of rabbinic orthodoxy, and it opposed the restriction of education to studying the Talmud. In worship, they used the vernacular language alongside Hebrew and Aramaic, with the wish to eventually replace Hebrew and Aramaic by whatever the local language was. And they campaigned for a relaxation of the dress code of the Orthodox and the laws concerning kosher food. And as the years passed, the Reform group also allowed organs and hymns into synagogues and other changes to worship. Reform Judaism was and remains a major division within Judaism. Reform Judaism is also known as liberal or progressive Judaism. The relevance of this to the Free Church work is that almost all the converts of the Free Church came from Reform Judaism and hardly any from Orthodox Judaism. Now, let's return to the history of Jonas Meyer. He became disenchanted with Reform Judaism when they denied the need for belief in a personal Messiah, which seemed to him the fundamental basis of all Judaism. So he then considered aligning with Orthodox Judaism, but was repelled by their coldness and their formality. So he did not know where to turn and was left without religious belief. Sometime before this crisis, he had again met his old state school teacher, Herr Kroll, who had endeavoured to persuade him of the truth of Christianity. Now, by God's providence, the two men came into contact yet again. And following Kroll's advice to study the New Testament earnestly, that was the means by which Jonas Meyer became persuaded of the truth of Christianity. And that prevented him continuing in his post as a Jewish preacher and teacher. He went to Berlin, where he met Karl Schwarz at the Free Church Mission, who cleared up many points for Meyer. He was baptized by Schwarz in Berlin, and he adopted the name Theodor, which means gift of God. So he became Theodor Jonas Meyer. Schwarz advised Meyer to study in the Free Church College of Aberdeen. You might wonder why a Jewish missionary in Berlin recommended Aberdeen. It was because of one of Schwarz's Jewish friends, a convert called Marcus Sachs, who was the Hebrew tutor there, and I'll speak about Sachs later. After a year in Aberdeen, Meyer was licensed by the Presbytery of Edinburgh, 1850, and became Hebrew tutor in New College for 9 years, acting as an assistant to Rabbi Duncan. At the same time, he labored among German Jews who were resident in Edinburgh, and he also translated several very substantial works of some Orthodox German Lutheran theologians into English. In the summer of 1857, the Jewish Committee of the Free Church sent Meyer on a tour of inquiry to what were known as the Danubian Principalities, which are nowadays two provinces of Romania, bordering the Black Sea, Wallachia and Moldova. This resulted in his appointment the following year to be their missionary at Galatz, a port city in the Danube Delta, about 50 miles inland from the Black Sea. He was ordained to that work by George Smeaton, who had just taken up his professorship at New College. After 3 years in Galatz, Meyer's health broke down, however, and he was obliged to leave the city. He then labored in Austria and Hungary. Then in 1862, he was able to resume work for the committee, this time at Ancona on the Adriatic coast of Italy. He learned Italian in an incredibly short time, being able to preach in that language a few months after arriving. And the field of his work there was large, as his was the only evangelical mission station on the whole of the east coast of Italy. He stayed in Italy for 5 years. Meyer's time in Italy ended when he was transferred to Amsterdam to replace his old friend Schwarz, who had moved to London. Meyer rapidly learned Dutch and continued the work among the Dutch Jews. In 1871, Theodor Meyer left both Amsterdam and the Free Church and moved to London. And there he labored among the Jews under a committee of the English Presbyterian Church till the end of 1894, when age and poor health obliged him to relinquish the work which he so dearly loved, and to which he had devoted all his energy for 44 years. He retired to Jersey, where he died 2 years later. Well, I've spent time on the first three biographical sketches, as they've illustrated some aspects of Jewish religion in the 19th century and the extent of the Free Church's commitment to evangelizing the Jews. The accounts of the next two ministers are a little less involved. The fourth minister whose life I'll sketch is Alexander Fürst, who was born in Prussia in 1831 in a small town now in northern Poland, about 150 miles from the present border with Germany. He was brought up as a strictly observant Jew, but the prayers and ceremonies were irksome to him. When he left his parental home, he threw off all the fetters of religion and essentially lived as an infidel. However, during the final 2 years at school, he had been under the influence of a pious Protestant teacher, and this led him to respect Christians and to lay aside his prejudices against them. Fürst trained as a teacher and went to work in a Jewish school in what is now northwest Poland. But he raised the issue of his disaffection with Judaism in conference with the local rabbi. He also conferred with a Christian missionary, which made the local Jews suspect that he was looking favorably on Christianity. He had to flee for his own safety to London in 1855, where he was admitted into the Home for Jewish Inquirers, where he received instruction in the Christian faith and was baptized at Trinity Chapel, which I've already mentioned, in 1856. If I may, I'll digress because of the importance of the Home for Jewish Inquirers in Scottish endeavours to evangelise Jews, and also to the link with Trinity Chapel. The home was run by a very influential converted Polish Jew who was born as Chaim Herschel. Herschel had immigrated to Britain, and he himself had been a resident in a similar London home for Jewish converts and inquirers. He was baptised and took the name Ridley instead of Chaim. Subsequently, he married a Scotswoman whom he had met at a London congregation of the Church of Scotland. In 1835, he declined a call to a congregation in Scotland as he wanted to work as an evangelist. And in 1838, he began work at a Church of Scotland chapel in the city of London near the Bank of England. John Duncan met Ridley Herschel as he passed through London on his way to the Pest Mission. And Duncan impressed on him the great need for evangelization among the 20,000 Jews in London, many of them recent immigrants from Europe. And that led to the formation of the British Society for the Propagation of the Gospel among the Jews in 1842, the organization I have mentioned in the introduction to the paper. Herschel then became the pastor of the large Trinity Chapel congregation and was succeeded in that pastorate by Carl Schwartz. So you see the connections existed and developed. So going back now to pick up the thread of Alexander Fürst. After his baptism, Fürst began to work as an assistant minister in London in Herschel's organization. And after 9 years, he was appointed to work as a missionary in Prussia in the present-day Polish city of Szczecin, which is often anglicized to Stettin. 5 years later, in 1872, he transferred to the service of the Jewish Committee of the Free Church of Scotland, possibly at the instigation of Carl Schwartz, who'd taken over from Herschel. Fürst was appointed to work among the Jews of Prague. Now, as well as being the largest Jewish community, Prague was a major centre, perhaps the major centre, for training Orthodox rabbis in Central Europe. And it's likely that he faced a very difficult field of labour. Perhaps because of that, 1 year later, Fürst, at his own suggestion, moved from Prague to work among the Jews in Strasbourg, which had become a German city by conquest in the recent Franco-Prussian War of 1870. He remained in Strasbourg for a year and then in 1884 was transferred to Amsterdam. The Free Church mission to the Jews in Amsterdam was in decline by that stage, and after 3 years' service there, Fürst retired from the Free Church to live at Stuttgart in southwest Germany. There he once more entered the service of the British Society for the Propagation of Gospel among the Jews, acting first as a helper and then a successor to a converted Jewish pastor in Stuttgart, until his own death in 1894, aged 68. He had worked among his brethren according to the flesh for 38 years, 15 of these being in the Free Church. The fifth minister on this list is Marcus Zachs. Unlike the previous four ministers who evangelized the Jews, the length and breadth of mainland Europe, the ministry of Marcus Zachs was confined to the Free Church within Scotland. Zachs was born in a small Prussian town in 1812 in the present day district of Poznan in central Poland, about 100 miles from the current border with Germany. To prepare him for university education, he was sent to stay with an uncle in Berlin, the head of a large brewery. He attended a gymnasium in Berlin where he immersed himself in classical Greek poetry. At university, he studied French literature, and these influences led him to abandon Judaism for atheistical views, views which were strongly influenced by the French Revolution. His fervent support for revolutionary opinions meant that he was debarred from public office in Germany. Other German freethinkers hypocritically professed Christianity in order to obtain such posts, but he couldn't conscientiously do so, and thus he left Germany in 1842, aged 30. Zachs sailed from Hamburg to London and then travelled to Edinburgh, where he arrived around the time of the disruption. Now, Zachs was conscious that there was a strong religious earnestness which he couldn't understand as a rationalist, and that disturbed his mind, and he sought to refortify himself in unbelief by reading an infidel book which he borrowed from a man whose acquaintance he had made. The man was Professor John Brown, minister of Broughton Place Secession Church in Edinburgh. When he returned the book, Brown asked Zachs if he would read a book on the other side of the argument, a French book containing letters by some Jews against Voltaire, the French philosopher who was such a pungent critic of both Judaism and Christianity. Zachs promised to do this, and this French book was the means, under the blessing of God, of not only restoring his belief in the Old Testament, but it also prepared his way for his conversion. Now, John Brown also lent him a book by a Dutch Arminian author. Zachs was very reticent about his soul's experience, but it would seem the first time that he read the words, "What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" was a time which the Lord blessed to him. Now, however inappropriate it was for John Brown to lend rationalist and Arminian books, Zachs wrote the following to Brown at the time of his baptism. Quote, "In order to trace the way in which the Lord has been pleased to lead me to the knowledge of divine truth, I am obliged to go back as far as to the day when I had the honour of making your acquaintance. For this event I consider as my first step towards the salvation of my soul, inasmuch as the kind reception you gave me disposed my mind to better feelings. I got at once rid of the absurd prejudice I entertained with regard to Christian clergy in general, and Presbyterian clergy in particular." After this, Marcus Zachs publicly professed his faith in Christ by baptism. And despite being a minister of the Secession Church, Brown advised him to attend the Free Church, and he became a member in Robert Candlish's congregation. Zachs resolved to study for the ministry and attended the divinity lectures of Thomas Chalmers. In 1846, after being licensed as a minister, he was appointed tutor in Hebrew to the Free Church Divinity Hall in Aberdeen. Free Church Assembly in Inverness in 1845 had appointed the foundation of a college in Aberdeen for the benefit of the students from the north of Scotland, and a building was opened there 5 years later in 1850. However, the Aberdeen College was always seen as a poor relation of its counterparts in Edinburgh and Glasgow, and for several years from its opening, only had one professor, I probably don't need to remind this audience that our own church in Aberdeen is housed in the former library of the Free Church College. And the college itself, which is now degraded to housing a bar and nightclub, is located on the other side of Alford Place. In 1855, Candlish successfully proposed Zachs as Professor of Hebrew and Exegetical Theology at the Aberdeen Free Church College. Zachs had already been Hebrew tutor for 9 years, and attendance on his classes had always been recognized as equivalent to attending those of a professor. Candlish said that Zachs had shown himself eminently qualified for giving instruction in the critical and exegetical study, both of the Hebrew and Greek scriptures. That proposal was supported by Rabbi Duncan and Professors Fairbairn and Smeaton, who testified wholeheartedly to Zachs's qualifications. Nonetheless, Candlish was not entirely fulsome in his praise, tempering it as follows, quote, "As might be supposed from his antecedents, i.e. Zach's Jewish background, he had a few peculiarities. He was very pugnacious, very dogmatic, very disputative, and very outspoken, raising arguments sometimes for argument's sake. But he, Candlish, was glad to learn that these roughnesses had been softened down by his residence among the friends in Aberdeen. Abroad, he had only studied literature and philosophy, but on coming to this country and after his conversion, he devoted himself to the ministry, studying under Dr. Chalmers and receiving license from the Presbytery of Edinburgh. As Hebrew tutor at Aberdeen, he had given the highest satisfaction, and altogether he, Candlish, was convinced the church would lose a most signal advantage if she did not avail herself of the service of Mr. Zachs." Opposition to Zach's appointment came from some ministers, however. One of them asserted there was no proof of Zach's qualifications for giving instruction in the critical and exegetical exposition of scriptures, and ominously stated that there were men in the Free Church fully qualified. However, the presbytery voted in favour of Zach's and took him on trial with a view to his being inducted as professor. By the way, in addition to Hebrew, he stimulated an interest in Arabic and German in Aberdeen. In 1862, Professor Zachs was considered as an assistant to Rabbi Duncan at New College, but that vacancy was filled by A.B. Davidson, who later became Duncan's successor. Unlike the other Jewish ministers in the Free Church, Marcus Zachs is not known to have evangelized even within the comparatively small Scottish Jewish community. His life was dedicated to teaching Hebrew and other languages to divinity students, and his literature output was negligible. His biographer characterized his teaching as follows. He was very patient and laborious in laying the foundation. His motto was ever thorough, and the contempt which he felt for anything unreal or not thorough extended itself to this domain. While full of encouragement to and even rejoicing over humble earnest, aspiring after more light and more knowledge on the part of the slowest student, he administered in the case of ignorant, presuming pseudo-students rebukes little to be envied. The fire of the old Hebrew race for truth and uprightness flashed out on such occasions in a way to be remembered. It appears that Zachs didn't confine his criticism to divinity students. His biographer continued, he had much to condemn in the so-called Christian world, and he frequently deplored the worldliness and utter materialism of many professing Christians, wearing phylacteries of words like the Jews and denying them by their lives. After Marcus Zachs died in 1869, aged 57, his former student, Theodor Jonas Meyer, was nominated for the vacancy, but it was the higher critic and heretic, William Robertson Smith, who was appointed. I've now come to consider the sixth and last Jewish minister on the list. The names of the previous five ministers are relatively obscure nowadays, perhaps it's fair to say unknown. However, this man was and remains a household name in evangelical Christian circles. In fact, he's so well known that his background in the Free Church is often completely overlooked. I refer to Alfred Edersheim, the author of renowned books such as The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, Sketches of Jewish Life, and The Temple and Its Ministry. Alfred Edersheim was born into a wealthy Jewish family in Vienna in 1825. He attended a local gymnasium and also a Jewish school to learn the Talmud and Hebrew. He was unusually able, not least as a linguist. As well as his native German, he could speak Latin, Greek, Hebrew, English, French, Hungarian, and Italian. He enrolled at Vienna University at the age of 16. But his father's death impoverished the family, and so he didn't complete his studies, and instead he went to become a teacher in Hungary. The following year, in 1842, he met John Duncan and the Scottish missionaries who had just begun their work in Pest. The Lord blessed the message of the gospel to him there. Now, shortly after the disruption took place in 1843, John Duncan was recalled to Edinburgh to become the first professor of Oriental languages at New College. The 18-year-old Alfred Edersheim accompanied him and lodged with the Duncans in Edinburgh. He began theological studies at New College, and he concluded his education by spending 1 year at the University of Berlin, where his professors were a mixture of evangelicals and rational higher critics. And that gave him a lifelong hatred of German higher critics. On returning to Edinburgh, the Free Church Presbytery of Edinburgh licensed him to preach the gospel. For a few months, he served the new Free Church congregation at Mackerston, a parish just to the west of Kelso. The Jewish committee then instructed him to sail to Constantinople, and from thence to travel overland to Yash, then known as Yasi or Jasi, on the present-day border of Romania with Moldova. There, the Free Church missionary minister Daniel Edward ordained Edersheim to be a missionary to the Jews. And that city of 50,000, Yash, included about 20,000 Jews who attended 200 different synagogues. For many reasons, including hostility from both the Orthodox Church and from the Orthodox Chabad Jews, Yash was a very unpromising territory. And only small numbers of Jews profess Christianity, some of them completely insincerely. A troublesome Scottish mission worker also greatly hindered the work there. And a year later, Edersheim was recalled to Scotland, and it was concluded that it was not expedient for him to return to Yash. He became the assistant minister to Robert Forbes at the Free Church in Woodside. In those days, a group of three small villages outside Aberdeen, but nowadays totally swallowed up within the city. His success as a preacher was remarkable. The church filled to overflowing. Pews, aisles, even pulpit steps were densely packed. And 4 months later, he received a call to the Free Church in Old Aberdeen, where he served for 12 years, from 1849 to 61. However, Old Aberdeen was very different territory from Woodside. It centred around the university, King's College, which was under the dead hand of moderatism, rationalism, atheism, and his congregation remained small. He was able to devote time to translating German books, mostly theological and philosophical works, into English. Eventually, in 1861, health problems forced Edersheim to resign from Old Aberdeen, and he moved to Torquay in Devon, a place popular with many Scots who went to enjoy the benefits of the warm climate, particularly people who had chest complaints. The Scots Presbyterian Church of St Andrew was built for him there, and among his congregation were Jessie Thane and her mother. You'll recall that Jessie was erroneously described as the fiancée of Robert Murray McChane, a myth that was dreamt up by romantically minded writers of the 20th century. In 1872, Edersheim retired again on health grounds, and for 4 years he lived quietly in Bournemouth. Now, when Edersheim was languishing in Old Aberdeen, he had begun to question his attachment to the Free Church, and later in life he reflected on these days as a Christian, or his earlier days. He said, "Of church questions, I knew absolutely nothing. They did not as yet arise. I had only learned the doctrines of Christianity from the New Testament, and the only outward church which I really knew that is, in the sense of being practically acquainted with it, was that of my teachers, the Scottish ministers. Just at that time, Dr. Duncan was called to occupy the chair of Oriental Languages in the newly formed New College of Edinburgh, and thither I accompanied him to study theology in Edinburgh. It was thus naturally and unconsciously, so far as church questions are concerned, that I became identified with the Presbyterian Church. Thus it was that 3 years after retiring to Bournemouth, Edersheim joined the Church of England. First he became the curate of a church at Christ Church in Hampshire. That lasted a year, and his further career consisted of being a vicar of a small rural parish in Dorset, followed by lectureships in London and Oxford. And he wrote, "I've passed from the Scotch to the English Church, and have not for one moment regretted the change. The changing was and is most unpleasant, but not the change. That has placed me where all my sympathies find most ample scope. I am convinced of the historical church. I believe in a national church. I prefer a liturgical church. And on these grounds, I have joined the Church of England." And it's during his time in the Church of England that he wrote most of the works for which he is now so warmly remembered. Edersheim died on the French Riviera in 1889, aged 64. Well, in drawing this paper to a close, it's clear that falling from the camel in Egypt did indeed lead to a remarkable period of evangelism among the Jews. As Dr. Keith lay ill in Hungary, the Archduchess initiated contact, which helped to smooth the way for future preaching to Scottish men, constructing a bridge across the Danube to link Buda with Pest, to form Budapest, and through that to preaching to the Hungarian Jews. Contact during that period with Israel Safir, the prominent and learned head of an influential Jewish family, led to Jews attending services. And many, including Israel and his son Adolf, attended with the less than worthy aim of simply learning English. But many were caught in the gospel net. Adolf Safir went to New College along with Alexander Thomery, but Dr. Keith recommended him as a Jewish missionary to the Irish Presbyterian Church. And after working in Hamburg, Adolf Safir then became a minister in England and a most able writer. But the Safir family and the Pest Mission feature directly or indirectly in the histories of all but one of the six ministers. In answer to centuries of prayer, and as a result of these men's untiring labours, many Jews in Europe and Britain came to profess faith in Christ during six decades of the 19th century.